Welcome to Switchblade Sisters, where women get together to slice and dice our favorite action and genre films. I'm April Wolf, recording in my home office with a lot of hot air, some special guest appearances potentially from my cat Chicken, maybe my cat Zoli, who knows. Every week I invite a new female filmmaker on, a writer, director, actor, or producer, and we talk in depth about one of their fave genre films, perhaps one that influenced their own work in some small way. And today I'm really excited to have writer Olivia Dufaux. Hi.
Hello. Hi, April. It's a pleasure to be here. You may hear my dog, Gus, chiming in as well, FYI.
Well, Gus, welcome to the show. for those of you who would like
to do the heavy lifting.
And it's tough because I don't have a bio for Gus, but I do have a bio for Olivia. So I can tell you what she's been up to. I do know that she is an award-winning playwright and screenwriter. Her plays include Year of the Rooster and The Tomb of King Tut, both New York Times critics picks, along with The Messenger and For Want of a Horse. She's the recipient of LARC's 2017 Venturous Playwrights Fellowship, the 2015 Playwrights of New York Fellowship, the 2013 David Colicchio Emerging Playwright Award, the 2010 Lipkin Playwriting Award, and 2008, 2009, and 2010 Harley Adair DeMann, I don't know, Playwriting Awards.
That sounds right to me.
Okay. Okay, so she's also a member of New Dramatists, the LCT Writers in Residence, and the Youngblood Playwriting Group, though writing for the stage, as you can tell from the early part of this bio, will always be her first home and her love, I'm assuming. Olivia did venture into television writing in 2016 when she joined the writing staff of the AMC show Preacher. And in 2019, she hopped over to the FX show Legion, where she served as an executive producer for the 8-episode third season, co-writing 6 of those episodes. But now, Olivia has jumped into the feature world with a film she wrote called The True Adventures of Wolf Boy, an unconventional coming-of-age story about a boy with a condition that causes thick hair to grow all over his face and body. When he receives a mysterious package, he goes on the run to search out the mother he never knew, interacting with a menagerie of misfits he meets along the way. The film is directed by Martin Krejci and is available to watch, I think, October 30th.
Yes, that's right, which I can barely believe myself.
It's nuts! But, you know, right in time for Halloween, if you need a feel-good, interesting coming-of-age story that, you know, just makes your heart beat a little bit faster. So, Olivia, the movie that you chose to talk about today is City of Lost Children, which I think has quite a few similarities to your movie. And so it's going to be, I think, a fun kind of dissection of those two projects. Can you give us a little explanation on why this is one of your fave genre films?
Sure. And I should say, like, I did specifically choose it because it felt connected to Wolf Boy in certain ways. Wolf Boy is unique amongst other things that I've written in that the audience intended for it is partially children. And so specifically, I guess I was thinking about the sort of movies I wanted or needed at that point in my life when I was like 13 or 14. So I wanted to select a film that I loved from that stage of my life. And I was crazy for City of Lost Children when I was young. I had the poster over my bed. I was just delighted by it. And I was unsure if it would hold up upon repeat viewings. And I'm pleased to say, for me at least, I enjoyed it a lot. I think it's breathlessly imaginative. I find that has a really interesting tone that vacillates between silliness and slapstick with earnestness, but also like violence and certain dark undertones. And, you know, at its core, I feel like it has a lovely little narrative of two kind of outcasts gradually letting down their barriers and forming sort of a found family together, mm-hmm. which is a plot that I can always get behind.
It's a love story in a sense too. You know, finding family, making family that you didn't have out of, you know, nothing. And I think for those of you who haven't seen City of Lost Children, however, today's episode will give you some spoilers. As always, though, that shouldn't stop you from listening, because my motto is that it's not what happens, but how it happens that makes a movie worth watching. Still, if you would like to pause this and watch The City of Lost Children, this is your shot. And now that you're back, I'm going to introduce The City of Lost Children with a somewhat quick synopsis. This was, I'm going to say, the hardest synopsis I've ever had to write.
You're welcome. I did like this. This movie is not known for its coherent plotting. That should not be your reason to watch this film.
You're like, I gotta know the plot. I've gotta know. Like, that's not at all the reason.
I just wanted to make you suffer, April, in attempting to recount this.
Okay. As I push my hair back and get ready for the synopsis, let's see how I stumble. Written by Gilles Adrien, Jean-Pierre Jeunet, and Marc Caro, and directed jointly by Jeunet and Caro, The City of Lost Children introduces us to Crank, a weird old man who lives on an island of his own making with a little person named Martha, a brain in a vat named Irvin, and six clones. Crank can't dream, and that ages him, so he enlists some blind cyborgs to steal children so he can extract their dreams. Meanwhile, a carnival strong... There's going to be a lot of meanwhiles in this. Meanwhile, a carnival strongman named One, played by Ron Perlman, adopts a little brother named Donri, who is then kidnapped by the cyborgs. One is pretty pissed, but also hopeless, until a gang of petty criminal children controlled by conjoined twins named the Octopus hire him to help with a heist. But he's interrupted when he spots the cyborgs who took Donri. One of the children, the precocious Miette, works with One to get to the cyborgs, but they are captured, and Miette falls off a plank seemingly to her death. Only an amnesiac diver then finds her and saves her life. Meanwhile, the old carnival owner, Marcello, uses his trained fleas that inject people with a serum to wreak a little havoc, an aggression serum to wreak a little havoc and save One. Miette confronts a drunken One and leaves with him, but the octopus thwarts their friendship and uses the flea serum to turn One against Miette. Something happens. Miette's single tear saves her life. It's pretty complicated.
Chaos
theory. Yeah. And Marcello finally does the octopus in. Crank orchestrates the release of a dream in a bottle that reaches Miette, One, and the diver, but Crank's plan to lure them to the island isn't so successful because the diver suddenly remembers that the island was actually his laboratory before Crank and Martha attacked him, causing him brain damage that makes him forget things. Anyway, they head over to Crank's place. Miette sneaks in and enters a captive Donri's dreams because the brain told her to, where she meets Dream Crank. She then controls the dream, outsmarting Crank and trapping him. Then she wakes up and saves Donri. The diver straps himself to an oil rig with a bunch of dynamite. The clones and the children escape, but the diver accidentally gets blown up when a bird lands on the bomb plunger. And, you know, it's okay. The city continues on as it was before.
April, that was impeccable. I think if anyone is confused, it's their fault.
Truly.
Or Jean-Pierre Jeunet's fault, really, probably.
I love, like, one of my favorite things of watching the commentary of this, or listening to the commentary track on the Blu-ray, was the fact that Jeunet, from the outset, said, even to me, this is very confusing. And he's completely open to the fact that, like, it is an extremely confusing thing. It was almost, you know, purposely so. And, you know, trying to blend the demands of having a movie that should be somewhat commercially successful, at least, but also something that you wanted to be almost infuriatingly complex. And I understand that kind of impetus that someone like Jeunet has, where you just want to, you're like, you know what, fuck it, fuck the narrative structure. I'm going to blow this shit up and literally at the end, and nobody is going to tell me no. And I'm curious about, you know, your experience, because I think I started off in playwriting as well. And one of the reasons why I loved playwriting was because it was so freeing. It, like, there was structure, but there was also people who were encouraging you to abandon it completely and experiment in that way. And I was hoping that you could kind of share some thoughts about that.
Sure. I mean, I agree with you that, like, what appealed to me about playwriting, and also what appeals to me oftentimes about filmmaking, is the level of freedom that's involved in how to tell a story. It's interesting with City of Lost Children in that it feels uniquely well suited for this film, in that it's a film somewhat about dream logic. Mm-hmm. It's a film also wherein it has lots of kind of Rube Goldberg-esque machines in the film as a whole. And the film kind of feels a bit like a Rube Goldberg machine in itself, sort of like lurching from one set piece to the next with things kind of haphazardly occurring. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, I love kind of imaginative forays. And I have, I think, as I've grown older, I feel like it's more and more useful for me to at times have a simpler structure and plot that I can hang all of my oddness and kind of unusual elements and unusual characters on top of. So I think a lot of times, especially these days, I'll try to think of a more streamlined plot that then allows me to go off and inject all of the kind of craziness that I so desire that otherwise might feel as if it is pulling the story in multiple different directions.
Yeah, because there is a, I would say, a slightly more traditional structure to the Wolf Boy movie, even though you have these very kind of off the wall characters who are there. So are you saying that like it's maybe more, people are more accepting of those off the wall characters if they can latch onto a structure that feels familiar?
I think so, and I think it also just helps me oftentimes as a writer. When I have just like a solid skeleton that I can move forward with,
I want to talk about the characters' names and how kind of Ron Perlman was approaching Genet, being an American actor who couldn't speak French, who was just like, okay, let me like figure out your process. He said, quote, "I only had one question when I first met Jean-Pierre, and I asked him for the explanation of the name of my character, One. And I said, why is he called One? And my curiosity was totally satisfied when he said, quote, why not? That's as much direction as I had," end quote.
Like, I love it.
I mean, there's an interesting things like the Miette is the name of the young girl, and that means crumb in French, which is like unfortunate in some ways for a lot of the Americans who named their children Miette and didn't know that it's like the name of so many bakeries in France.
My children to be named crumb, frankly. That's a name that I would endorse.
You're like, more of this.
Yeah, more crumbs.
And then, you know, having the English word for one, you know, single one being this other character's name, there was so much of it that was just like a sense of why not? And maybe that's particularly how these three creators approached that. You studied playwriting, am I correct?
I went to school at Sarah Lawrence College and studied playwriting there, though I have no formal education in screenwriting.
And that doesn't matter.
It's sort of self-taught. Yeah, right. I think it actually hinders you in a lot of ways.
Yeah, you just read the scripts, know the structure, know how to do it. Yeah.
I had that exact experience.
But I'm wondering for you, I mean, like the fact that I think when you're studying, because Genet was self-taught, you know, he's a self-taught filmmaker, which I always found fascinating. And which means that he probably didn't have a lot of people in school, you know, who were like, well, why are you doing this? Questioning that. And I understand the impetus of asking that in, you know, kind of writing programs are just like, why are you doing this? But I also love the kind of courage to just say, why not? Hopefully it's a good enough idea that why not is sustainable, but it's not always. But, you know, when you were studying, did you ever feel like you had
Please suggest and clarify my thought process. I mean, I suppose at times everything that I've worked in has always been somewhat outlandish. And, you know, I exclusively like to work on things that I feel like could not be created by anyone other than myself. And I think that that can at times lead to people questioning certain decisions and certain decision-making processes. I do think, you know, I've been fortunate that a lot of the projects that I've been involved in have had a tremendous amount of freedom associated with them, either through my ignorance in terms of like when I was writing this movie, I didn't, you know, I was younger. I was like 7 years younger than I am now, actually. And I was, you know, was not as immersed in the television film world. So I didn't think about, for example, like the technical difficulties of like, oh, there's going to need to be a 14-year-old boy or 13-year-old boy with hair on his face for the entirety of the film, which in retrospect is like a tremendously challenging ask.
Yeah, you're just like, I don't know, do it. I don't know.
Write on the page. I mean, that's what I'm also accustomed to, you know, in theater. It's something that I would love to do in theater is I'd write just fucking insane stage directions. You know, like, it begins to rain frogs or shit like that. That would be related to the plot in some way, but that would challenge the set designers or the other designers to come up with imaginative, interesting ways to depict these things. And I mean, I think the same is true a lot for my writing these days as well, where I like to repeatedly kind of challenge designers in terms of what I write. I think that was especially true when I was working on Legion, where there was a surprising amount of freedom considering like the large budget and property that we had to work with. And so often it was just kind of the going through the process of play and just kind of trying to figure out what was, because just in a very, I guess, similar to Save Lost Children, thinking of things in a more stream of consciousness, dream logic sort of, sort of narrative, and trying to connect with kind of the part of myself that is most imaginative in trying not to feel bogged down by any of the constraints that I or others can place upon the work.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll talk more of The City of Lost Children, and we'll be right back.
Hi. Are you someone who thinks that when one door closes, another one opens?
Someone who always sees the light at the end of the tunnel?
If you answered yes to one or both of these questions, good for you.
We are not those people.
Nope. I'm Annabelle Gurwitch, and I'm a, you know that other door opening? It probably leads to a broom closet kind of person.
And I'm Laura House. When I see a light at the end of a tunnel, I assume it's a train headed right toward me.
Laura and I have created a brand new podcast for people like us. It's called Tiny Victories. We're sharing personal tiny victories or things we've read or seen that inspire resilience.
So if you're looking for a tiny reason to get out of bed each week, subscribe to Tiny Victories.
Available on Maximum Fun or wherever you get your podcasts.
Let's get tiny.
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm joined today by Olivia Dufault, and we're talking about The City of Lost Children. So Ron Perlman was and is still in awe of this movie. He was so grateful that he was just some American that was asked to be in it, even though he didn't speak any French. But in the commentary, he was noting that despite the fact that Genet was just like, I'm not sure about this opening, it's very confusing, he was just like, hell yes, this is the perfect opening. He said, quote, one of the hallmarks of the film is that you are so disoriented. You're thrown into a world of chaos, and you as the audience become a participant in that chaos and disorientation. I love films that you're experiencing on a visceral level, and the intellectual explanation of them comes some 20, 30 minutes after the fact. And then you go on to a whole new series of disorienting events, end quote. And that's something that we talk about a little bit on the show, I would say, is the idea of how to open up your project, your movie, your film, your book, everything, that like how to drop that viewer into this world to tell them that this is not necessarily the world that you're used to and you need to be ready for certain things, specifically with genre projects, you know, because you're just like, it's different world building. So I was hoping that you could maybe talk about that. I mean,
I love the opening of City of Lost Children. I love that it potentially feels like a different movie entirely than what you get. I love it's like it begins like a sweet Christmas movie essentially before becoming like transitioning into a strange nightmare with reindeers shitting all over the place.
Yeah, what the fuck?
I love that. I remember when I watched it as a child, when I saw the reindeer shit, I was like, I'm in. This has So I'm saying begin your projects with animals shitting is primarily my point. No. I mean, I think more and more I think about kind of what is the first image that I want audience members to see? What is the first kind of bit of dialogue? How are you being introduced to this world, as you said? And I think that, I mean, like, I always enjoy, I suppose, and this is, maybe this goes back to some of my theater roots, but I enjoy a lot of times a big, like, propulsive, almost like a beginning where it's sort of some sort of fanfare almost, as like a, look, we're putting on a show in a way. And I think that centering certain scenes that will do so, that have that kind of strange propulsive energy is nice in terms of carrying it through for the remainder of the film.
I want to go into some more character building things, because the characters in The City of Lost Children are, they're like vaguely drawn, but they're also kind of archetypally drawn, you know, like, yeah. And so I'm curious about that. There's one thing, for instance, where, like, as Ron Perlman was saying, he didn't really get much direction from Janae in that thing. Like, he was hired because Janae and Mark Caro had seen him in Kronos and was just like, oh, who was that weird looking guy? We need that guy. We can't find any Frenchmen who remotely even have that kind of vibe that he does. And so for him, all he knew was that he knew Jean-Pierre wanted to create a fish out of water thing with this character. And I know that you're going to be able to speak to that a bit. But he said, quote, Jean-Pierre realized he wanted to create a sort of fish out of water, a country bumpkin in the world of a city in an advanced state of detritus. That was the innocence represented in that character. One way of doing that is to make him a foreigner. We decided to make him some undisclosed Baltic origin, probably Russian. It's bad French I'm speaking, but it's French with a Russian accent, end quote. And so he couldn't be American because there's a certain thing, but you have to, like, it's something that's like playing with nationalities, making someone like foreign in some way, like the kind of quote unquote, like, you are not of this place. And, you know, I think that could be, it could be sometimes offensive or it could be really effective. And
yeah, Lost Children, sometimes that was my primary concern, frankly, upon rewatching it, is like how much of these tropes surrounding, you know, conjoined twins and circus strongmen mm-hmm. are going to feel exploitative versus celebratory or and I found myself pleasantly surprised upon rewatching it. I think that, I mean, something that really appealed to me as a child watching this film is that pretty much every character in it is a sort of outsider, mm-hmm. an outcast trying to just survive in this really harsh, inhospitable landscape. And I think that in some ways, like, no one really feels completely, I don't know, I guess, at home in this strange world. Everyone's kind of seems to be looking for a way out. And I think that the idea of just like struggling misfits attempting to forge their own path, especially when I was that age, really mm-hmm. Struck me.
But how would you say one would go about creating the character of the quote-unquote freak?
Yeah, it's interesting because, like, I think that freak is, it's a term that I struggle with a lot, and a term that I was very, like, consciously thinking about and dealing with when I was writing about with Wolf Boy. Because Wolf Boy is, right, like, it's an allegory in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, it's, like, the obvious allegory, right? Of, like, which I think is an allegory that a lot of times people use when discussing, you know, like, sideshow conventions, which is that freak, quote-unquote, becomes representative of anyone who struggles to fit inside the constraints of society. Anyone who feels different, who feels as if they are, as if they are marginalized, essentially. But, you know, when I was writing Wolf Boy, again, this was like 7 years ago, and I was personally going through the experience, I'm a trans woman, and I was going through the experience of transitioning myself. Mm-hmm. And I was, you know, and I wrote this film when I was kind of really confronting the fact that I needed to transition in order to survive and improve my life. Yeah. And I was experiencing I would experience harassment on the street, you know, when I initially was presenting in a way that kind of blurred boundaries between male and female. And something that I would get called a lot was freak. And that really made me want to write something that took this terminology and took kind of sideshow characteristics and maybe make a more direct allegory to the process and of transitioning and to the mm-hmm. process of kind of self-acceptance, which is something that is simple to say and simple, easier, and also easy to write about, but which in reality is extraordinarily difficult. Mm-hmm. Something that, like, I think my favorite character in City of Lost Children is the octopus. In some ways, I feel like I wish that the octopus was the protagonist of the whole film. And I really enjoy the kind of backstory that is implied that this woman was, or these women were previously kind of exclusively a sideshow attraction being contained by this ringleader, but now are in a position where the ringleader is this kind of drunken deadbeat buffoon, mm-hmm. and they are in a position of power where they have control, you know, where they're essentially running an orphanage for petty thieves or for child thieves.
Yeah. I mean, their character is such a, it's something like when I first watched it, I was just like, oh yeah, they're like the evil people. And then I think that like when you watch it again, like if you're a little bit older too, you're like, oh, this is a little bit more complex than one would think, especially in their death scene too. Like they're kind of, and what Janae said, quote, was when the sisters are going to die, they say some very tough things about the life they had. And during the rehearsal, it was like psychotherapy between them. They said some things about when they were children, you know, it was real and it was very special. And that's on screen, end quote. So there's just like, it's a fascinating thing that happened with them. Like they feel very real and they don't feel just all bad, villainous.
Yeah, and I do, you know, I, as I grow older, upon viewing this, I found myself like empathizing with the villainous characters, maybe even more so than the protagonists. I think that's something, it's fascinating to me that the characters in this are like overtly evil in a lot of ways, they are punished for being so in this kind of fairy tale morality type of way. But also, I don't know, I have great empathy for the octopus. I have great empathy for Crank, who I initially found so grotesque when I was younger, and now I'm like, oh god, I get it, man, like you just want to dream.
Yeah. And also like that actor Daniel Emelfork, who plays Crank, he was just a really phenomenal person, but as you know, Janae and everyone else on set said, like he was also just like kind of out there. He was like wild and very difficult. And as
that
Janae said,
surprised me.
No. Janae said, quote, "The old man is so crazy. I remember when we began to shoot with the kid and the old man was so upset. He wanted the kid to apologize to the old man. He was four, man. The old man said to the kid, 'I am a great actor. Who are you?' Each day this man wanted to kill us," end quote.
I love it. That seems perfect. That fits within my conception of the character completely.
But also they wrote that character for him.
For him, yes.
I mean, if we're talking about someone who continues like to write for someone, the fact that like Dominique Pignon was in like everything.
Everything that Junet did, and yeah, it has like six roles in this one.
Yeah, actually, I mean, like, he's got six clones, and then he's like the other guy, so he's got seven roles.
I love that's Junaid's muse. Like, it's really, you know, like, I love having muses, and I think one of the reasons Junaid says he's like feels so inspired by Dominique is just that he has a weird face that he likes to look at, and I completely empathize with that, just in terms of the joys of finding atypical muses out in this mm-hmm. world.
But I mean, also, like the atypical muse, but we're kind of in a time period where it feels like everyone really, really has to be kind of like traditionally like beautiful in these,
yes,
in these specific ways.
Oh, I know. It's what bothers me most in terms of television and film and moving from theater to television and film. I completely agree. I find myself, it's much more difficult for me to empathize with attractive human beings. No, that's not true. But it is true that there does seem to at times be a barrier in terms of like weird wish fulfillment, that we celebrate very specific types of male and female beauty, which I think is very detrimental to our mental well-being and society as a whole.
Now, don't get me wrong. Dan Stevens is a fucking god.
Oh, Dan Stevens, of course. A gorgeous god.
Well, you got to write for some, like, how do I move this god creature around?
and is beautiful and attractive as physically and emotionally. He's a wonderful human. I just want to ugly him up more, I suppose.
We're going to take another quick break. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit more on the City of Lost Children and also Adventures of Wolfpaw. We're going to talk Legion, all of these other things. We'll be right back.
We interrupt the podcast you're listening to tell you about another podcast. That's right. We Got This with Mark and Hal.
That's correct, Mark. This is Hal. We do the hard work for you, settling all of the meaningless arguments you have with your friends.
So tune in every week on the Maximum Fun Network for We Got This with Mark and Hal. And all your questions will be asked and answered.
You're welcome.
All right. That's enough of that.
We got this.
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm joined today by Olivia Dufault, and we're talking The City of Lost Children. I want to move into something that Junaid has talked about but somewhat at length, but the idea of cruelty versus gore and the kind of childlike nature that he has to his films and how he is exploring cruelty without gore most of the time. He said, quote, and this actually relates back to kind of like writing somewhat for children too. So, quote, the film is meant for children as well as adults, but as always at the outset, the film was made first of all for ourselves. It's true that we've stayed very childlike though. If you look at Pinocchio, Dumbo, Snow White, Bambi, there are some awful enough scenes that make an impression. I think that an audience member, whether big or little, wants to feel afraid, to have fun, to be moved, to cry, in short, to be surprised. There has to be a little of all those emotions. The idea is to rediscover a little the childhood fears, those in tales that were told to us. So this is far from being gory. Yet in the tales, when you read Grimm or Perrault, there's a certain cruelty, end quote. And I think it's an interesting thing to think about what we deem acceptable for children to see. What is cruelty? What are the lines? What is gore? Because those things can be, they're vague definitions. I think, you know, the filmmaker has to decide for themselves what those are. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I mean, something that did always appeal to me with this film is that it's pretty cruel to its characters, especially in the outset. And that's also, I think, what weirdly makes that tear moment so moving to me, is like, it's the one time where the universe seems to like allow for something good to happen, because otherwise it's just like this world is uninhabitable in so many different ways. Mm-hmm. I think that I think that for me, especially as a child, I always gravitated towards the idea of, or towards films which presented a certain cruelty in terms of just growing up and in terms of the world that you're exposed to. I think I'm a big proponent in that way, I suppose, of there being like more cruelty in what's conventionally called children's films. Mm-hmm. I think that too often, there's a built-in support system for children, for like the child inside a film, and so much of a coming of age story I think comes from confronting the cruelty and also confronting the lack of kind of structures that are set in place to help you and to provide assistance. Mm-hmm. And that's what makes, I think, this more meaningful, I guess, the movie more meaningful as it becomes gradually more about kinder and gentler and more about kind of folks being able to earnestly support one another in ways that they would be incapable of doing so before.
Did you have to draw a line though when you were writing like Wolf Boy? Like, what was your line?
Yeah, well, I will say that there were like initial drafts of Wolf Boy, I'm gonna say, definitely included some dog fighting scenes, which I removed.
Olivia, what are you doing?
No, right? This is like a great insight into like the way that, into also like so much. I guess this is also what I was saying. Like, typically, I rarely wrote for a younger audience. So I was like, kids love dog fights, right? children are all about dog fights. And as I continued to revise the script, I was like, you know what? This dog fighting seems like it exists in a completely different movie in terms of just like the cruelty that's on display towards this child and towards these dogs is like unwatchable. I guess my answer is dog fighting is when the cruelty becomes unsustainable.
I think that's a pretty good line to draw it at. You're bringing up something that I'm curious about, something we kind of talked a little bit about earlier in the different ways, and that's chaos theory and writing things that are nearly unfilmable and how you deal with that. Because Janae said, quote, "I have something of a gift for writing this kind of thing, and it's a real pleasure to dream up, say, that little mouse with the magnet or the dog pulling the pulley. But it's in the staging that it's complicated. But with the teardrop, this goes much further because it's a ludicrous illustration of the chaos theory where one incident leads into another. It's amusing to know that someone's teardrop, a symbol of her sorrow, depicted by a simple drop of water, saves her life by becoming, at the end, a cargo boat 400 meters high that breaks up a bridge of boats. But between writing it on paper and directing it, it's not the same thing. I was quite a challenge for the special effects men directly responsible for doing it," end quote.
Yeah, and there were several moments in Wolf Boy or in Legion where I would just have to, you know, reckon with the practical challenges.
Is there anything you can share with us from either project that like you just couldn't do that you like wanted to do?
There's a lot of things. I mean, with Legion, I was really dead set for a while. We had an enormous CGI pig, and I really wanted that enormous CGI pig to die and to like have its carcass, like have a huge skeleton of a pig that people were like, because people in Legion, people, you know, followers of Dan Stevens were suckling on like the teats of this enormous pig. And I was like, let's get an enormous pig skeleton. And that was never deemed important enough to the story. And I kept trying to force it in there. with Wolf Boy, I mean, there were earlier drafts, you know, like the structure of it is one wherein the story is interrupted by chapter breaks where you have illustrations depicting to the fairy tale analogs of these characters. Mm. And there was a period where I was wondering if I could lean more into that and actually like depict, you know, have an actual pirate ship with this character dressed as a pirate that we would briefly flash to, you know, for these, for very, very brief periods.
You saying briefly makes people say like, we're getting rid of that.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I like how I'm like, it's okay. It's brief. We only need this pirate ship for a brief period of time. But yeah, there's just, maybe this is all to say that's another thing I think that's actually interesting about comic books compared to television and film, is that in comic books, you have no budget whatsoever and limitless imagination, which does appeal to me in a lot of ways. But I will say that, like, as I also think that so much great art comes from restraints, whether it be from, like, in playwriting, the restraints of certain of not being able to maybe move between times and spaces as potentially easily as you would be otherwise. And then there are just so many practical restraints that you have to deal with when making film and television. And I think a lot of times those do result in a more interesting, stronger end product. I think, yeah, limitations help.
But that segues nicely, I think, into something that Junaid always had a hard time with when it came to kind of live action things, because he said, quote, "In France, they love realistic cinema. They hate when it's aesthetic. They love to work with reality. For me as a director, it's not interesting. It's like doing photography. I feel like a painter. It's probably because I come from animation. I was speaking about that with Terry Gilliam a long time ago. He was saying exactly the same thing. When you come from animation, you like to control everything. And recently I was in London at the Tate Gallery and I saw the Turner exhibition. This guy was transforming the reality because he was a painter. So I feel like a painter. I don't care about reality. I think an artist has to have a special look on the world, otherwise it's boring," end quote.
I agree, Junaid.
But you know, that's something that I hear from it's a weird thing, because I hear it from a lot of creators, especially people who come on the show, because whenever we do kind of like more fantastic movies, talk about that, usually the filmmaker talks about how they don't like that everyone wants reality, and they're like kind of, you know, penned into this audience desire to have reality, and so they have to keep doing it even though that's particularly not what is enthusing them. And so, you know, I happen to hear that a lot, and I just don't understand, like, can't we just overcome this? Can't we just
I mean, it does. It seems like increasingly people are recognizing the wide breadth that genre films can have, which is exciting. But even the term genre film is kind of like, can frustrate me and annoy me in certain ways, because it's like anything outside the realm of naturalism is seen as like a genre film, and it's like, no.
But that's the thing, like, that's why naturalism is so huge, that you have to classify everything else outside of it is, yeah, I mean, it's incredibly frustrating.
It's so, you know, I've always exclusively gravitated towards, I mean, whether it be for reasons of escapism, but more frequently, I think it's because I feel like the things that resonate with me most tend to be metaphors and allegories. You know, I oftentimes, you know, I feel things in a heightened way, and the best way to oftentimes represent these is through things that break down the traditional barriers of reality, or what we expect to see from reality.
It's a tall order, but someone's got to do it.
Someone has to make reindeer poop on the floor.
Olivia, I want to thank you so much for coming to talk with us today about The City of Lost Children. And I want to remind people that they can see The True Adventures of Wolf Boy starting on October 30th. And where can people see that? How?
Can watch it on Amazon or iTunes or wherever else, I guess, films are sold.
And also go back and take a look at season 3 of Legion, where Olivia was controlling everything. that look that you just gave me.
Yeah, absolutely. I want complete and total credit for that. No, I should say no. Noah Hawley is wonderful to work with and an amazing collaborator. And I learned so much from that experience.
Yeah. Thank you again so much for joining us today. And please check out Olivia's movie. And thank you for listening to Switchblade Sisters. If you would like to tell us what you think of the show, you can tweet at us at Switchblade Pod or email us at SwitchbladeSisters@MaximumFun.org. And please check out our Facebook group too. That's Facebook.com/groups/SwitchbladeSisters. Our producer is Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. And this is a production of MaximumFun.org.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.